Hey everybody, this is Alex, and we're back. We're
Back from
back.
summer hiatus.
We're back.
Because
We
it's
just
winter hiatus where I am.
I guess it was winter hiatus, it was spring hiatus for me. It was just a big hiatus, and which is it's unfortunate that we took the hiatus when we did because there's been a lot of movies coming out. So we're going to be a little behind, but I think we'll get caught up. And there's been a lot of incredible visual effects movies, I think this summer. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been jam-packed, really.
Yeah, I think that the thing that I'm starting to notice is that I'm really feeling like you're getting to the point where you can do just about anything. And we're now really in many cases, at least for the major feature films, it seems like we're really what we like and don't like are starting to be really, really small little things. It's not these egregious errors that we used to see in many films years, in the previous years.
Yeah, I think that, the production push is definitely a problem because I don't think we're getting time to we're not getting the filmmakers time to take those visual effects, incorporate them in the storytelling and see whether or not the story is being told effectively. But I think you're right, the actual individual shots are good.
That was a really nice way to say that.
Well, it's not the visual effects guy's fault.
No, I agree. If you're going to spend $300 million or $200 million or whatever on a film, it'd be great to spend $2 or $3 million on the script. That's all I'm saying.
Well, see, now I don't think it isn't the script. See, this is I've got a theory here. I don't think that they have a problem with the script, though obviously sometimes they do. But I think the problem is that you need to craft a film, right? There's the film you write, the film you shoot, and the film you edit. And the problem is we're missing the last of those three, right? So the adage is that, it looks great on paper, then when you get on set, things change, you do things differently, and you improve it because the actors obviously now have the material. And when you get into the edit, you then see how that fits together, and sometimes it fits together differently than how you expected. And the film we're talking about today is Pirates, and in Pirates, they were locking reels off before they'd finished the edit of other reels, right? So they're literally saying, oh, we're reel one's locked, all the effects are in, we're done, start, go, we'll just start worrying about finishing the edit on the other reels. I mean, how can you do that? How can you not see the film done, complete, and then revise the character arcs and everything else? So I think it's the editing because of the crunch in post that's hurting the film.
Yeah, and it seems like it. I know you want to have it. You want to, obviously there's dates and there's times to release stuff. But if you're releasing something as big as Pirates, I get that there's certain times that would be as good as any to release it. But there are, there's a lot of other times that you could release it and it would still be very successful. And it seems like giving people a little bit more time to kind of complete the project seems like it would make a fair bit of sense.
Now, I'll point out this, that isn't just, I mean, we obviously think of it as being a universal problem, and to a certain extent it is, but it isn't every film, because while they had a huge crunch on Pirates and Transformers, I know for a fact, because I've just done a podcast that's coming out on about the 1st of August with the guys at Double Negative on Harry Potter, and they had something like 15 to 19 months working on that film. Now, they got brought in at pre-production, and they worked all the way through the film and just managed to develop stuff up and solve problems and just dealt with a whole lot of stuff. And I was stunned by that. And they were like, well, they're making a lot of these films. They know how to make Harry Potter films, right? Like they're obviously, it's well thought through and they know that's happening. Now, I guess my point would, why isn't that the same with Pirates, right? They must have known they were doing what they were doing with Pirates. So
Yeah,
why couldn't they
it's
have given ILM more time?
yeah. I mean, and that's the because especially when you look at the push for Pirates 3, you have a situation where I mean they shot two films together. So I mean the stuff was there. It's just a matter of kind of sorting that out, and that does put an enormous amount of pressure on the VFX firm. But I think that it also comes down to, I mean, I think that this idea that unlimited resources gets you the best movie doesn't necessarily always make sense. It might make enough money to make it worth it, but I think that it is, oftentimes there's a maybe it's because there's so many people working on it, maybe because there's so many fingers in the jar because there's so much money there that it gets kind of torn back and forth and moved around. I mean, you end up with a movie that, I mean, I think Pirates is once again one of the best visual effects films that I've ever seen, but not one that I was that inspired to go see again.
You know, I think it's really interesting. And if I can just sort of do a weird cross-promotional thing for your book reading on Pixel Core of Stu's book, right?
Yeah.
The DV Rebel. There's a great bit in there where he's talking about if you want to wet down the road and you're an independent filmmaker, you wait till it rains. And it's sort of like, you know, there must have been... because we had this come up in some discussions about how you put effect shots through really quickly and, you know, rapid turnaround. And obviously, if you've got a lot of shots that are the same, you'd like the same artist to work on them. But right. when you crunch the schedules this hard, you have to say, look, I know you've worked on the other shot that looks exactly the same as this. You understand all the issues, but I'm going to have to get somebody else to do it because you just don't have enough time to do it. And so it's the exact opposite of the independent filmmaker. It's like, you know, natural things that would make the film easier to do, you can't even do because you have no time.
Yeah, and we've had that not so much related to visual effects at the moment, but also related to with my, you know, we're working on, we do a lot of podcasts, and some of them are kind of visual effects, not visual effects as far as the content, but that we have to add a lot of stuff to it. And with one of the podcasts, you know, we typically throw it out to 10 people and they all come back and they all look good. And we took this experiment of what if we have just one editor work on the whole thing and put it all together, and the result, you know, it took a little bit longer to get it done, but the result was so much higher that, you know, it caused us to rethink a lot of our distribution methods, you know, because there is some, there's something that's very hard to put your finger on that makes a big difference when people can kind of sit there and look at it. And you don't always have that, you know, you don't always have that, that luxury, you know, when you're working on anything. But it is something that there is a cohesiveness, I think, that is often missing with a lot of the stuff. And at the same time, you know, it's amazing, you know, what they are getting done. I mean, I think that if, as we look really beyond the story of it and really look into a lot of the details of Pirates, I think it's a pretty amazing film. So the stats here, what are the stats? We have everybody worked on it.
For the film, right? I mean, obviously ILM was the lead facility, and right. And John Knowles, visual effects supervisor, and of course, you know, you can't beat John Knowles as visual effects supervisor.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's what you got to do. and 756 shots, I think, for Industrial Light and Magic, 315 shots for Digital Domain. Asylum came in at 240 shots, 225 for CIS Hollywood. The Orphanage did 39 shots. Method did 38 shots. Pacific Title and Art Studio did mostly sky replacements, 390 of those. Luma Pictures brought in 19 shots. Evil Eye Productions, 68 shots. So it was just an amazing, you know, and this is, I guess, pretty much par for the course at this point. You know, you have some of these companies that are specializing. I think that obviously a lot of the money shots that we saw were, you know, really shared, in my opinion, probably between Industrial Light and Magic and Digital Domain. And I think that that's a model that I feel like I'm seeing more often, you know, is this idea that you have a couple big firms that kind of deal with most of the, you know, kind of this requires an enormous amount of infrastructure to get done. And then a lot of the little stuff is all, not little stuff, I shouldn't say it that way, but some of the smaller stuff can be farmed out to a lot of different companies that where it's not as important to have it all kind of tied in. Do you think that that's going to be a constant trend?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think the schedules dictate it, really.
And I think that one of the things, I mean, do you think that is not just with schedules, but do you think we're getting to a point where you have a lot of companies who aren't really interested in becoming the next ILM or Digital Domain? They're interested in taking on their own niche and then letting them do that one big piece?
Well, you got to understand, it actually helps the ebb and cycle of the business. Because, you know, in the old days, it used to be boom and bust. Because if you got the show, you got it all. If you didn't get the show, you laid people off.
Right.
Well, now, of course, you can be, you know, actually having work, spill work or 911 work from other facilities to fill in your low periods. So it kind of actually evens things out. Actually, I think makes sense from a production point of view, just that the post community doesn't, you know, kill itself by sharing the love around a bit. And so everybody isn't, as I say, on a, you know, flood or famine.
And I think it also keeps people from gorging quite so much. You know, a lot of times when you're a little visual effects company or a little production company in general, you get this work and you want to take on as many shots as you can because you don't know when the next project's going to come through. because it was all or nothing. And now you're kind of, well, you know, I'll take a couple of shots here and then I'll take the next ones there. And because you have to work with everyone, you got to make sure that you don't drop them.
And that is healthy because you can keep your staff, and keeping staff is a good thing.
It is, although I think that's another thing that seems to be happening a lot in most of these companies is the actual ramp up and down of the staff, you know, where we're still a lot of the people are keeping a core staff, the people that really make a difference there, but it seems like it's becoming 30, 40, 50% of the staff is getting hired for the project and then let go, which is a big change from when I was at.
I have this view of a nomadic sort of herd of shake compositors moving around the globe like a locust fest, and there's some airline that hasn't yet worked out that they need to do a special, you know, we're offering flights from Weta to ILM for the start of the next film, kind of just keep moving this locust plague of talented compositors around the world. God knows how they do it with their families.
It's so funny because we have a bunch of, you know, we have a lot of shake compositors in the Pixel Corps, and it is funny because you see this movement of artists who are like that, you know, and they just kind of moving through, and Shake doesn't, because Apple, you know, hasn't done as much, you know, they've kind of end of lifed it until they bring out whatever they're going to bring out. It's funny that it doesn't have as much, you don't see it as much in the news because they're not pushing as much PR, but that's pretty much still that backbone, you know, that's really
big.
All of these companies. And it's also, I mean, one of the things that I've seen it really drive the industry is that you need what people use as a program has so much to do with the artists nowadays. You know, if they can't find, it's not whether it's a better 3D app or a better compositing app, it's can I find, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 artists to use it within the production cycle that I have.
Well, I mean, the other thing, and I can't talk too much about this because I'm under about a billion NDAs, but, you know, most of these post houses bought the source code.
Right.
So it's not like Shake is dead. It's just Shake as sold by Apple is not being sold.
Right.
Kind of end of life.
Right. And I think there's, you know, I think that, yeah, it'll definitely be moving forward in one way or another. So, and I think there's a room for other compositing applications as well, but so what did you think? What jumped out at you the most in Pirates?
In terms of good visual effects, or well, yeah, I guess the thing for me is the and I'm kind of partly cheating here because I saw a bit on how it was done behind the scenes at the VES conference, but the end sequence with the water was particularly impressive. Because normally, as you know, the way you do three-dimensional water, and I thought it was really funny because John Knowles joked that he'd gone 2.5 movies desperately trying not to do 3D water for a Pirates movie. And, you know, that did a little bit, like 300 shots or something, but just there were splashes and stuff.
Right.
Characters coming out of the water kind of stuff. They'd have to put, you know, the sort of disturbed water in on top of the natural water. But they didn't do the big stuff, right? Having, you know, Poseidon and all these other films out there, there's clearly the able to do water, but it was like, we're just going to stay away from fluid sims on tight schedules, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, to get slightly geeky for a second, the way that 3D water works, as you know, Alex, is that it works off what's called a voxel. So if you think of a pixel as being a flat 2D thing, it's obviously got an area. If we were to blow up a screen and we'd look at it, a pixel is an X and Y kind of square, like a box, like a tile. A voxel is more like a cardboard box. And so the way that the 3D stuff works is it's volumetric, so it works off these spaces, these cubes, these 3D boxes, these cardboard boxes in space. Now, of course, if you've got water that's lying pretty flat, then the water goes up and down a bit. But if you think about it in terms of volume, you only need to go, you know, a meter below the surface and a meter above the surface, and you've kind of got where all the wave action is. Pretty easy, really. Well, not really easy, but in fact, incredibly computationally hard. But the point is that you've only got about a meter above and a meter below you have to worry about. And you suddenly put a funnel in, and you suddenly have, 100 meters down and 100 meters across. And so the computational voxels that you have to actually deal with to do a funnel of water is just exponential off the dial. It's just like, it's like if it was really hard to do fluid dynamics when you only had to do it sort of X and Y and a bit of Z, you now have to do massive amounts of Z. And you know, even ILM, that's just a crushing amount of compute power. I mean, these are like some of the most amazing fluid sims ever. So I guess I just can't move away from that end period of just being stunned at what the guys managed to pull off.
Yeah, I was very, extremely impressed with it, of course, and it, you know, from the sheer weight of what that of what that took. You know, it is, and I've only played a little bit with that stuff. And the voxels, you know, the voxel technology, I mean, a lot of our, it's not just what we use for water. I mean, a lot of people use it for, you know, a fluid sim is, you know, fire. It's, you know, people use it for smoke. They'll use it for all these things. But, and each one of those pieces is really, you know, pushing all that stuff through. And it is something that when you increase the area, it's not like just making the picture bigger, as you said. It's the depth, you know, is an exponential problem. And so it is, you know, that was something, and it was one of those things, like I looked at it and I wasn't even sure if it was, the funny thing is I looked at the film, I wasn't even sure if it was necessary, you know, to the film to have them swirling around on this, but man, I was really glad they added it. the one thing that I thought was particularly impressive was the outdoor scene where they were kind of meeting, you know, on the, you know, out on the sand.
In the nether regions, lost world, end of the world.
But
thing?
When they were negotiating, there was the negotiation, right. With Johnny Depp and with you know, when they were there was like six of them sitting there, you know, walking across this, and it's just this beautiful outdoor scene of these folks that are going back and forth with each other, and you're looking at complete CG characters standing next to human characters standing outside, and there's nowhere to run. It's slow moves. It's not a bunch of shaky cameras. It's just there, and it just works, you know, in my opinion. Did you, was that how it looked for you?
No, totally. I think Pirates 3, you know, it's like each Pirates film, they conquered another bit of the problem, and they obviously in 2 pretty much conquered the single camera motion capture that allowed them to do such superb tracking, building of the 3D characters, and then, as you say, just great shaders to make those 3D characters look good. And so that those 3D characters moved forward into from 2 to 3. So I guess I was discounting them, I guess, because I'd seen them in 2, right. And had been just knocked my socks off there. And in terms of the film 3, I stupidly, irresponsibly, immorally had discounted how hard they'd be to do the third time round.
And it was just one of those things that I think that what showed up for me was the what showed up for me was just that it was so normal that we're looking at these great images and it hasn't been always that way, you know, and that the last one was really great, but there was something about that specific shot that it no longer was about doing a visual effects shot either. It was just a very, very normal shot that was very, very well done. And you just didn't, you got to a point where you're looking at the characters and you're not thinking about it. And I think that that's something that we're just moving into this realm where we're starting to not have to go, well, that was just what we could do with visual effects. You know, and I think that, you know, even when, you know, when you watch Star Wars, for instance, it's really, really great, but you don't really look at that stuff and think that, oh, that's, you know, I can go and touch it, you know, in the same way, I'd say.
I will say that Yoda had, Yoda in, I think, 3 had the first time that I looked at a CG character and I was like, oh my God, that is getting tactile. So I'm going to disagree with you slightly there, because I really think that they nailed it on some of the close-up stuff with Yoda in the third Star Wars, or the, you know what I mean, the sixth Star Wars.
And I thought that Yoda was close. You know, it was one of those things that I don't think he's as far along as what we're seeing here. But definitely he was the closest thing I'd seen, you know, prior to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, that there's that fight scene in the bloody great chamber of whatever it is with the pods, only there's no one in them. It's like, you know, Senate chamber and there's no one in it, and they have a lightsaber battle and Yoda's clinging on to something about to fall. Mm-hmm. And I was just so worried about poor Yoda dying, and I'm like, well, hang on a second, this guy's just not even a... Like, I guess that was a tipping point for me. But, you know, you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, the characters and the other thing about 3, and that's, you know, and I'm surprised we've gone this far into the podcast without me sort of carrying on about it, is, you know, it had Keith. I have a Keith for President t-shirt. I love Keith. And Keith, the fact that Keith's still alive is the most amazing visual effect in history.
It's a visual effect of its own. I mean, and you look at him and you're like, wow, he doesn't even look like he's... He looks like he's really alive, like they're not pumping something into him.
You know, once John Lee Hooker died, Keith became the coolest man living and certainly the man most voted indestructible by nature. And yes, I was a bit disappointed in how little we saw of Keith. But yes, the fact that it had Keith in it would be reason enough for me to go and see the movie.
It's so funny when the rumor started coming out that Keith Richards was going to be in the actual movie. That was a very, very interesting process. Although I don't think he should give up his... day job, whatever that is.
Do you know that they were on set and the director, I read this in an article, but I can't remember who to credit, I apologize, but somebody wrote this, that the director said on set, Johnny Depp would act just like Keith, but he would switch it off when the cameras were off, right? Keith was on set and there was just no off switch because that's just how he is. It was like, it was just almost like they wanted to say, okay, you can cut now, Keith, but there was no cutting with Keith. It was just like that. But yes, now, I guess Walt Disney was slightly disappointed that he snorted his own father's ashes and thus couldn't be used in the publicity for the film. But apart from that...
Jeez. Now, the other thing that we should, you know, not... It's easy to get caught up in the water and the 3D, but the other thing that there was an enormous amount of here were miniatures, real time, full level sets. I mean, they really, you know, there's a lot of stuff here that wasn't done in CG. You know, you'd think that you could do it all in CG nowadays, but there's an enormous amount of it that is still being done at, you know, scale models, 30 foot ships, shot a lot of them were shot at Kerner Optical. And put together and really I thought that integration worked really well as well. Did you?
Yeah, and I don't want to take nothing away from Kerner Optical, but did you also see the photos in Cinefix of the rig that they had at, I think it was like the Spruce Goose Dome or whatever it was, for the end sequence, the two pirate ships on gimbals with a watering system?
Yeah.
I mean, that was unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a really... And there's something about that, and I think that this is one of the things that this is one of the advantages of having a visual effects supervisor like John Knoll, who's kind of come from all these different backgrounds, is that you have, a lot of times you have visual effects supervisors who are more comfortable with one or the other. You know, they're more comfortable with having, everything be physical, or they're more comfortable with doing as much digitally as we can, and we'll only use physical if we have to, and there's all this back and forth and everything else. And I think that what you really see there when you're seeing pirates is a visual effects supervisor who is very, very comfortable with both sides of the fence. And we're really exactly what's necessary to pull off the shot.
It was, I think it was John Frazier that did the gimbals. Mm-hmm. And for people that don't understand what is involved here, I mean, you've got a whole lot of actors, so there's a huge amount of safety issues on something the size of a, you know, huge ship, all on a joystick. So on a stage that is so huge that it's just unfathomable to me. And the whole thing is being wet, driven by massive pumps. There were like 8 Pantech trucks outside with just the generators to get the lighting for the setup.
And when you look at the lights, if you look at Cinefix, for instance, and you look at the diffuse lighting at the top, I think each one of those lights is like a, you know, I want to say a 5K or something. I mean, it's a lot more power than I have in my office. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, they do it very well. Don't get me wrong. And we were shooting this week for FX PhD with Ross Emery, who did the green screen lighting for Superman Returns. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, Ross is a hell of a nice guy, right? And he was just joking. He said, you know, they wanted to shoot Superman flying, so they actually, you know, obviously had him standing up, and there were guys sort of on his side, and there were guys puppeteering his cape and stuff. Right. But he'd be like, well, I want a 270-degree green screen, you know, psych thing lit here. And I want it, you know, 300 feet across. And, you know, I'm not making these numbers up, just enormous things. And he'd just say that one afternoon and come in the next morning, and they'd built it, lit it, set the f-stop to what he'd asked for. And there was a dummy, you know, guy standing there just for him to look at to see if he liked it when he walked on the first, you know, the next day. And I mean, I guess we talk about the visual effects, but as you've alluded to, the physical crews that are helping the visual effects teams on set are like the unsung heroes. Like, and there is a lot of people on set that are helping these visual effects artists and people like John Knowles that are building these things and going to enormous lengths to, I mean, I just can't believe how much work they went to them.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing pre-pro meeting.
And it was, and one of the things that you look at is also in how many pieces would you put together. So if you look at one of these big ships, partial ships, for instance, that are sitting on gimbals and they're swinging back and forth, they then have to take that ship in, match move it to a, you know, and then possibly marry it up with the miniature, you know, to make sure that it all, you know, fits all together. That has a whole other layer of, you know, complexity where you have your match moving something, then you take that match move and you convert it. So what happens is on a lot of the stuff when you're seeing the miniatures there and oftentimes with the with the full sized or the partial ships, what you're seeing is they have an outdoor shot or they have the large ship shot, and then they're actually needing to you match move that data, so you reverse engineer where the camera is, and then you take that camera data that you figured out and you export it back out into a generally a text format of rotation and then you rotation position of where the camera has to be. Then you export this little text document out, and then you put it into a in Kerner, I think they use a Cooper system, and but there's a whole bunch of different, you know, there's Milo systems and Cooper systems and lots of, you know, motion control systems, and what you and then you get it in there, and then it has to reproduce that data, and then of course that data never actually completely syncs up with what you shot. So then you end up with these two composites where everything is mostly moving right together, but there's still like this little bobbles that go between, you know, what was actually shot on set and versus what was shot on a miniature, and then the compositor sits there and has to kind of blend all that stuff together. And it seems like when you see the shot, and a lot of these shots, I mean, I had the opportunity to see a couple things, and when you see the shot in the movie, you know, when you have any idea of the length of amount of time that was required for the last like 4 seconds that you looked at, it's truly an amazing process.
I'll tell you a couple of funny anecdotes from John's presentation to the VES Society in Los Angeles. Firstly, on some of those shots where they were trying to get that last bit you were just talking about, He admitted that they just occasionally throw a wave or a splash in to hide it because it was just, you know, on the schedule they were on, it didn't matter.
Did they talk at all about the wire rigging in the past?
Well, let me just say before I do get to this, that the process you just described, I just think, I mean, and I don't mean to take anything away from the guys, but he also discussed a shot like that. Two ships on gimbals, everything you just described, right? They get to it and then they go, you know what? The shot isn't dramatic enough. They had a guy swinging from one ship to the other on a rope. Of the two gimbaled ships, all of the actors on the ships, the massive storm on a green screen, everything you just described, the only thing that made it into the final plate was the guy on the rope swinging between the two. The ships were replaced, the shot was replaced, everything else was digital. Right. The only thing left was the guy swinging on the rope.
And a lot of times you just end up with this, you cut it down for whatever reason, but that was one thing that it sounded like, not, you know, that it was just a crazy shoot. You know, I mean, all the time, you know, putting that stuff together. And I know a lot of those guys were grinding it out right to the end, especially with like a lot of the miniature stuff and everything else. I was just getting that all working. Now, did he talk at all about the masts?
He talked about obviously extending masts and the fact that most of the places, like even when they were destroying ships and stuff, they couldn't have masts there because they were worried about the way the ship would break up and stuff. So a lot of the complexity of having to put on digital masks to match live action, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things you also have is just compositing those masts. It seems like a really simple thing. We shoot a ship in front of a green screen, and then we composite it. You know, you pull the green screen, you put it over top and everything else. But just like hair, you know, all those little wires that are going between the masts, you know, there is an enormous amount of little wires that are oftentimes when the ship is actually moving are motion blurred, like if it's jiggling or doing anything it's supposed to do or the camera's moving. They are thinner oftentimes or as thin as a single pixel kind of going down, you know, through it where your eye can see it, but there's almost no way to, you know, no way to key it, no way to put that stuff together. It's quite an amazing thing to have it come back out and even look like it makes sense. Because if you miss
totally.
It, look wrong.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it is almost too hard to imagine how some of those shots with smoke and water could have been keyed. I mean, the quality of the setup was brilliant, but you just can't throw that much atmosphere and that much water between you and a green screen and get a good key.
Yeah, so it's but overall, I thought, I mean, the one thing that I've talked to some people and they've heard how, you know, they've heard a lot of complaints about the quality of the film and the story and everything else. I will say, you know, this late in the game, if you have not seen Pirates 3 on the big screen, you really want to see it on a big screen before you see it on DVD. You know, you really be missing out if you don't see. This is really a fest. Regardless of what you think about the story, and you can deal with all the stuff you want, it's just, I think visually, it's a really amazing movie to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, hats off to all the visual effects houses that worked on it, not just ILM, because, yeah, it really would be one to put on your showreel.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mike, where can people find out more about FX PhD?
Surprisingly, at www.fxphd.com. So we have obviously the two sites, FX PhD for serious visual effects training.
Show notes.
And then our, well, we got over at the at our news site, fxguide.com. We have just launched a TV show called FX Guide TV. And yeah, I mean, we don't do anywhere near as many video podcasts as you, Alex, but we but what we do, we love.
No,
we craft our little ones as much today. But yeah, it's good. And we have Angie's our host, and she's doing a great job. And it's just really taken off. It's been really successful.
Excellent. And we'll actually be showing, I think we're going to be showing on Inside the Black Box within the next few weeks. People should go up to pixelcore.tv and keep your eye on it. We should be showing some motion control stuff that we were actually a part of in the last couple months. So stay tuned for that as well. And until later, keep it real.
See ya.